Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm your host, Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
I'm Matt Ganeshta.
And joining us today all the way across the pond in the UK is a friend of the show, Benedict Rogers. Benedict, why don't you introduce yourself?
Thank you. Well, it's great to be with you. I would introduce myself very simply just as a human rights activist and a writer. I have three organizations that I'm involved with, Christian Solidarity Worldwide, Hong Kong Watch, which I founded, and the Conservative Party Human Rights Commission here in the UK.
Out of curiosity, is Conservative Party in the UK the same as we understand it in the US?
Well, it depends. I'm not quite sure how you understand it in the US. A lot of things in the US politics are difficult for me to understand now.
Yeah, what with all the freedom we have that you don't?
Yes.
That's the problem.
Yes, that is the problem.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of freedom, I know the UK got slammed for a lack of freedom of the press last week. At a conference about Hong Kong democracy activists, there were some people who were very rude to an honest, hardworking reporter from Chinese state-run media, and you were there. Why don't you tell us what happened?
Well, so this was a meeting at the Conservative Party conference. It was what we call a fringe meeting. So it's like there are lots of parallel side meetings on the fringes of the main conference. And the conference is the closest thing we would have to the conventions that you have in the United States. But we do it every year and on a much more much smaller scale. Mm. At this fringe event, which was focused on Hong Kong, it was organized by the Conservative Party Human Rights Commission together with Hong Kong Watch. We had three of the most prominent Hong Kong pro-democracy activists of three generations, Martin Lee, the founder of the Democratic Party of Hong Kong, Benny Tai, one of the leaders of the Occupy movement, and Nathan Law, one of the leaders of the Umbrella movement, who then went to prison. And I spoke as well, and a member of parliament, Fiona Bruce, chaired the event. And basically the event was very well attended, and everything had been very orderly until right at the very end. We were about to conclude. And Fiona Bruce asked me if I would make some penultimate remarks in response to a few questions that had come up in the Q&A before Martin Lee would have the final word. And after answering some questions, I said something that I feel very strongly about, and I felt it was important to say, particularly because I knew there were Chinese embassy officials in the room and other Chinese in the room.
They're big supporters of democracy in Hong Kong.
Of course, absolutely, and they've fulfilled their promises under the joint declaration to the letter. I said was very deliberate, which was, I am pro China. I'm not anti China in the sense that I'm pro the people and the country of China. I'm a critic of the Chinese Communist Party and the regime, but I want China as a country and as a people to succeed. And I believe that it's in China's interests as well as Hong Kong's interests for Hong Kong to succeed and for the promises that China has made to the people of Hong Kong and the one country, two systems principle to be honored. And as I finished saying that, this woman started literally screaming at me. I mean, I've heard hecklers, of course, but I don't think I've ever heard someone scream with as much ferocity and I would even use the word perhaps venom, in her voice. And she shouted at me, you're a liar, you're anti-China, you want to divide China. But the problem was she wouldn't stop. It's fine to rant for a few moments, but then you should sit down once you've had your say. But she kept going. And so Fiona Bruce, the Member of Parliament chairing the event, said to her very calmly, very politely, okay, madam, you've had your say. Now we're going to hear from Martin Lee. And she wouldn't. She wouldn't stop. And so one of the volunteers who'd been helping with the event approached her and said, madam, I think you should leave. And she slapped him. And then some other people came along, also very calmly, very orderly, and again said, madam, you should leave. And she slapped the first guy a second time. And in fact, she then hit him, I think, a third time as well. There is a video that went out But the video doesn't capture.
We actually have a copy of that video, so how about we play that right now so everyone has a sense of what happened.
Ma'am, are you... Can you please go? Can you please go? You are in the Conservative Party conference. This is the Conservative Party. Please go. Can you please go? If you hit me again, I will call the police. You are assaulting me. If you hit me again, I will call the police.
You have no right.
You are
no Democrat.
You are assaulting me.
I'm a German
citizen.
I
reserve the right to call
the police. No, you have no right. You have no right.
You could really see the slap in that audio.
Mm-hmm.
I should just say that the video only captures some of what happened, because obviously we weren't anticipating this. So whoever it was filmed it, didn't get their camera ready at the first instant.
Well, that's your problem, not expecting something like this at this point.
I mean, you're British, so you expect everyone to be incredibly polite all the time.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Which is why the government of the UK made the mistake of thinking the Communist Party would honor the joint declaration in the first place.
Yes. Yes. I think that's a fair comment.
So what ended up happening to the CCTV reporter?
Well, so eventually the conference hall security came first, and they took her out, and then she was handed over to the police. And I believe that she was held overnight, and she was then released after 24 hours or so, unfortunately without charge, although the police have said they're continuing to investigate. I'm not quite sure where things are at now. But
Did the Chinese embassy step in and say, get her out of there, release her?
They did. I don't know precisely what they said to the police, but they also issued a public statement saying that we were the ones who should apologize. First of all, their statement was quite ironic and quite contradictory, because they, on the one hand, tried to present her case as a press freedom issue, and that claimed that we had silenced her, which is obviously nonsense. I mean,
how dare you guys in the UK restrict press freedom in your country?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Whereas in China, of course, there's no restrictions, obviously. But I mean, obviously, that was nonsense. If she had asked a question or made a comment, however hostile or challenging, if she'd done it in an appropriate manner, then she would have been perfectly welcome to do that. But anyway, so they said we were violating her freedom as a journalist. But in the next sentence, they then said we should apologize for holding the event in the first place, because we had absolutely no right to be talking about Hong Kong.
Of course. But don't you think, I hear British people love to apologize. Don't you think the Communist Party was just giving you a nice opportunity to do what you love?
we will apologize for things that we think there's some basis, even if it's not 100%. For doing so, or we'll stand at a door and say after you for about half an hour, and nobody will move. But on something like this, of course, there's absolutely no basis for apology at all.
Well, it's funny that they're talking about press freedom in the UK right now, considering they just denied in Hong Kong, they just denied the media visa for a Financial Times reporter. Did you hear about
that? That's right. Yes, exactly. And it's shocking in itself, and it's even more shocking that it happened in the same week as this incident. And the idea, I mean, I worked in Hong Kong as a journalist from 1997 to 2002, and I would never have foreseen then that the Asia editor of the Financial Times and the vice president of the Foreign Correspondents Club would be thrown out of Hong Kong. And the only reason he was thrown out was that he had hosted an event with a young political activist who gave a speech at the Foreign Correspondents Club.
Horrible crime. But
absolutely.
This is definitely something you can relate to, right? Being not allowed entry into Hong Kong?
That's exactly right. I mean, it's almost a year to the day. It was on the 11th of October that I was refused entry to Hong Kong. So I could very much relate to Victor Mallet's case. I mean, the difference, of course, is that he was already in Hong Kong and his visa has not been renewed. So he's being thrown out. I couldn't even get in.
Why didn't they let you in?
Well, I mean, you really have to ask them. I've been asking them for the past year and getting no answer. clearly they were worried by my activism on behalf of Hong Kong. The reality is I was only going to Hong Kong to have private meetings with a few old friends and new friends, and I wasn't going to do anything public, and really they had nothing to worry about, but they obviously thought otherwise.
As I understand it, ever since that happened, you've been getting some very special attention from the Communist Party.
I have, yes. I've received now five letters, and not only have I received them, but three of those letters went to most, if not all, of my neighbours in my street in the suburbs of London. One went to my mother in the countryside, and one went to the trustees of CSW, Christian Solidarity Worldwide, which is the organisation I work for full-time. Mm. So clearly an attempt to try and put pressure on me through my neighbours, my family and my employers.
What did these letters say?
The first one, which was when it came through the door, even before I opened it, I thought it was strange because it had a Hong Kong stamp and Hong Kong postmark. And immediately I thought it's strange because none of my friends and contacts in Hong Kong have my home address. And even if they did, they wouldn't use it. You know, they use modern technology to reach me. But when I opened it, on one side of the page was a photograph of me taken from the internet and the words "watch him," and then on the other side and then on the other side a bizarre letter basically saying, and it was addressed to Dear Resident, so it wasn't addressed to me, and it said, this guy Ben Rogers lives in your street, he claims to be a human rights activist, but in reality he works for British intelligence.
Oh, my God.
And, I always got a James Bond feel for me.
Yeah, exactly. And so the letters were in some ways sinister, or obviously the intention was to be sinister, but they were also laughable. I mean, the sinister thing was obviously how they got my home address and subsequently my mother's home address. But the content was laughable. It claimed that I was an intelligence agent, not a human rights activist. And it ended with this suggestion to my neighbors that they should keep an eye on me, find out what I'm doing, and buy me a cold beer in order to do that.
Well, that's nice.
And one of my neighbors, who I didn't previously know, got in touch and did actually buy me a cold beer. So I got a free beer out of it, which I'm grateful to the CCP for.
They're just being neighborly. That's nice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Intimidation. The Communist Party is doing it wrong.
So who sent the letter?
Well, all the letters have been anonymous. So I have absolutely no idea at all who sent them. I've talked to, you know, a lot of friends who from China and from Hong Kong who say this has all the hallmarks of, at some level, the CCP. But it may well be that they're using, you know, a sort of amateurish person to actually write the letters. But to have the resources to research where I live and send all these letters, it has to be someone bigger than just an ordinary kind of crazy person.
It just strikes me as it's not very clear what the point of those letters would be.
Well, one Chinese friend of mine said to me that this is absolutely standard tactics in the mainland, and it's happening more and more in Hong Kong as well, to try to put intimidate people through, you know, damaging their reputation with their neighbors, putting pressure on them through their family, and threatening their livelihoods through their employers. The weird thing is that they think this would actually work in London.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess there's like the history in China, like in the Cultural Revolution, when you did have neighbors watching neighbors, and it was this, you know, very oppressive environment. And
I mean, I think you still have that in mainland China.
Oh, definitely. And I could see, like you said, Benedict, that it would seem to work there. But it is kind of comical, the idea that, like, they could pressure your neighbors into keeping an eye on you by sending an anonymous letter.
Exactly. I mean, it's if anything, it's had the opposite effect. I've got to know some neighbors I didn't previously know. Some of them have told me that when they got these letters, they Googled me and to find out what I was about, and they're very supportive of the work I do. And my mother just laughed and said, you know, the idea that she could tell me to stop doing something after all these years. She said, you know, she said, I've been trying all my life, and I know.
Wow.
So, yeah, no, and my mother's very supportive of what I do. So, it had the opposite effect. I think.
Yeah. So not only did it not intimidate you, it made other people learn more about the causes that the CCP wants to keep quiet.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. I mean, neighbors who probably knew nothing. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to make assumptions, but probably knew little about what was happening in China and in Hong Kong. Now know a lot more because it's being exported to their street in a small way.
Okay, here's a conspiracy theory. What if the Chinese Communist Party, all along, their goal was to create such a horrible repressive environment in order to bring the rest of the world together in love and harmony?
I suppose that's win-win cooperation.
That's win-win cooperation. Oh my gosh, we're through the looking glass here, people.
I mean, but it is kind of funny, the kind of self-own and like how it, you know, it just completely backfired on them is kind of similar to the CCTV reporter yelling in the middle of this conference on Hong Kong. Like, if she hadn't said anything, then probably this conference would not have exactly made the international news, right?
Probably not.
That's exactly right. I mean, we had 80 people in the room, and I doubt very much that if it hadn't been for that incident, that it would have got really any media attention. I mean, maybe a little bit in the Hong Kong press because of Martin Lee and Benny Tai and Nathan Law, but otherwise it certainly wouldn't have made the international press. And the same is true of my attempt to visit Hong Kong last year. If they'd let me in quietly, I might have written an op-ed, which a few people may have read, but not much more than that. And certainly my neighbors would never have known about what's going on.
Yeah. And the best part is it gave us two topics to talk about on China Uncensored.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, I guess like the same thing with the CCTV reporter in a way is like, what did she think she was going to accomplish, right? Like, does the Chinese Communist Party or like the way they operate, do they just not understand what it's doing to their international reputation when they do these kinds of things?
Well, there is one theory that I've read in a few articles over the last week. There's a very good article in Foreign Policy magazine, which says that actually it's highly likely that this was intentional and that it was staged. It wasn't just a sort of impromptu fit of rage on her part, but that her audience was not the international audience. Her audience was the domestic audience in China, and particularly the leadership. And it was designed to ingratiate herself with her superiors, to show herself, you know, standing up for China against these evil colonialists.
So she may have just slapped her way to a promotion?
Yeah, quite possibly, yes.
Let me try that. Didn't work. Well, yeah, she's being called a hero in China now for that.
Yes, exactly. And that, I think, further suggests that that was her audience. And that's the sad thing is that, you know, her response was in reaction to me saying that I am pro-China. I'm pro the people and the country of China. But now it's her who's celebrated in China.
Mm-hmm. Well, we found an interesting quote from the former head of CCTV. I don't remember exactly what it was, but essentially it was that any journalist working for CCTV who is concerned about professionalism.
Oh, yeah, who thinks of themselves as a professional and not a propaganda worker is, like, this is not the quote, but is, you know,
is making a fundamental mistake about their identity.
Now, something like that.
Between the three of us, we remembered more or less.
Yeah.
But yeah, just that very open statement that CCTV, we're here to make propaganda.
Absolutely. And indeed, I seem to recall, and my memory is about as good as yours on this, but...
so perfect.
I seem to recall Xi Jinping himself made at least one speech, maybe several speeches, to various different media groups in China about their role being to promote Xi Jinping thought and promote the party. And so it's come from the very top.
Speaking of Xi Jinping thought, did you hear about the game show about Xi Jinping thought they have in China?
I did hear about it. And I only know a little, but I still don't quite know what Xi Jinping thought is. So I probably would do very badly
in the
game.
It's the thought for a new era.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course.
So that's, now we know.
And something about Great. The Chinese dream.
Oh yeah, the Chinese dream.
Yes. Yes. So are we able to, are we equipped to play that the game show, do you think?
Oh, I think
on that basis?
I think so. I mean, there are no prizes or cash awards, so it doesn't matter.
What you want to play the game show right now? I'll ask a few questions about Xi Jinping, and we'll see who can.
Let's do it.
Who can win no prizes at all?
All right, let's do it.
Really?
Okay, Shelley.
I am totally not
Benedict,
ready for this.
Me. All right.
So jump in if you think you have the answer. What year was Xi Jinping elected by the National People's Congress to become the president, the legitimate president of China?
I believe, and such a wonderful democracy. And you remember the woman last week at our party conference kept shouting that there's no democracy in Britain. Of course, there is in China. I believe it was 2012.
I think it's 2013. Shelley, it's March of 2013.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah,
Shelley's correct. It is March of 2013.
Well, I can't blame Benedict for not understanding how democracy works, since there is none in the UK. You have that horrible tyrannical queen.
It was but you're also right, Benedict, because he was appointed his highest title, of course, his Communist Party General Secretary title in 2012.
Oh, it was a trick question.
It was a trick question, Matt. Yeah.
One more question.
Let's do simpler questions. All right. What is Xi Jinping's? I have to figure out a fair question that Benedict would have equal knowledge about. Gosh.
Wow, this game show sucks.
what year was Xi Jinping born?
Trick question. He wasn't born. He was gifted to the people of humanity from from Mao.
Correct.
But he probably was carrying a Winnie the Pooh bear as a toddler.
If that was the case, there would be no photos of that allowed.
I sure watched a lot of Winnie the Pooh growing up. It's a weird how my life has beginning and now has tied together with Winnie the Pooh.
I thought you were going to ask about Xi Jinping's pants.
How high are Xi Jinping's pants?
Sky's the limit. Just like the Chinese dream.
I mean, that's a joke. There's a Tumblr called How High Are Xi Jinping's Pants?
And is that because he only has one belt and he only walks along one road?
Oh, we're not the only one making puns about China. So who won the game show?
I think our guest won with that last comment.
Really, I feel like everyone lost, especially the audience.
Especially the host, who couldn't come up with good questions for that.
I was like, I feel like this is not a good idea, but you know, you're gonna go for it.
I mean, had we actually thought about it while planning the podcast, I think it might have worked.
That implies we planned this podcast.
Well,
it's called China Unscripted.
That's true. All right. Is there anything else on our list of things to talk about?
Yes, there's loads Matt, of stuff. I mean, Chris.
Oh gosh, so much pressure. Well, so Benedict, obviously this ties into everything that's been happening in Hong Kong. What is your sense of the situation there now? Nice, broad, open-ended question. There you go.
Yes. My sense is that, really over the last 2 or 3 years in particular, hardly a day has gone by without another example of the undermining, the erosion of basic freedoms, of Hong Kong's autonomy, and of one country, two systems. So Hong Kong is in a very bad way. Martin Lee gave an interview on the BBC at the beginning of his visit to the UK, and his opening comment to a similar question was Hong Kong is going down the drain very fast.
That doesn't sound very optimistic.
It doesn't. I mean, I think it's a far worse situation than I would have ever anticipated. Of course, I didn't believe that the Chinese Communist Party would honor all its promises. Of course, I imagined there would be some subtle chipping away at Hong Kong's freedoms, but I didn't imagine it to be as dramatic as it has been. You know, we've seen booksellers abducted. We've seen young pro-democracy activists jailed. We've seen democracy candidates disqualified from the legislature, real pressure on press freedom, academic freedom. And I think the refusal of Victor Mallet's visa this week. The Financial Times Asia news editor. I think that kind of caps it all. So I think the situation is increasingly urgent for the international community, for my country in particular, but for the United States and others to really pay attention to and to speak out on.
Well, you mentioned your country. What do you think the role of the UK ought to be in Hong Kong right now?
Well, the UK has not just moral and historic obligations for obvious reasons, but it actually has a legal obligation under the Sino-British Joint Declaration, which is valid, is a treaty lodged at the United Nations. It's valid until 2047. So at least until 2047, Britain has a legal obligation to monitor and speak out on questions of Hong Kong's freedoms and autonomy. China obviously keeps saying Britain has no business doing so, but we do. The Joint Declaration is, surprise, surprise, a declaration between two countries, China and Britain. So I think there's a lot more that we should be doing. To be fair to the British government, the language that it has been using, particularly in its 6 monthly reports and in some of its statements, has certainly become more robust in the last couple of years than it used to be, although that's coming from a very low bar. But I think there's much more it can do to speak up for Hong Kong. Of course, leverage is limited, but I think if Britain can rally other countries to speak out with it, particularly the United States, then, you know, that's what we should be doing.
But there's no clause in the Joint Declaration that's like, if China breaks its end of the deal, then, you know, Britain can take Hong Kong back. So there's not a whole lot that the Great Britain can actually do.
That's true. And certainly, of course, we can't take Hong Kong back. However, in 1996, the Prime Minister at the time, John Major, visiting Hong Kong a year before the handover, actually said that if the Joint Declaration was breached by China, Britain should look at every possible tool that it has, diplomatic and legal, because it is a legal treaty lodged at the United Nations, and should pursue every means possible to ensure that the promises are not breached. So he said the words, Hong Kong will never have to walk alone. So I think we need to remember his words and look at what we can do through the United Nations, through other legal channels to uphold. And I think one important message for the international community is, if China is allowed to get away with breaching this international treaty, what does that say about its ability to honor every other international treaty? And what does that say, therefore, for people who, for countries doing business with China? I think it ought to worry them. And so, you know, we should be pursuing all possible avenues for addressing this.
What are some of the legal ways, avenues open to the UK?
Well, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not sure. But I do think if it is a treaty lodged at the United Nations, there ought to be channels through the various international, I mean, maybe the International Court of Justice or the other various international legal mechanisms.
Do you think that what's happening in Hong Kong in terms of the erosion of freedom there? Is it reversible?
Reversible.
Yeah.
No, I think it is reversible. If I personally think there needs to be probably three things that need to happen. There needs to be a real effort on the part of like-minded countries around the world, Britain in the lead, but with other allies internationally speaking out on it. There needs to be there is already a movement within Hong Kong, and they need our support to be able to speak out more strongly themselves. And then I think it would obviously require some rethinking in both Beijing and in the Hong Kong government, which I think is not impossible if there is enough sustained international pressure. And particularly, I mean, in the current trade war between the US and China, Hong Kong obviously is an extremely important part of that. And if Hong Kong's rule of law and basic freedoms continue to be eroded, that ought to worry the business community, because Hong Kong prides itself in being the gateway to China and indeed to the rest of the region.
Well, it seems like the business community in Hong Kong isn't particularly outspoken about this.
That's correct at the moment, yes. But I think if things continue, and particularly, I mean, this is where I think we've mentioned several times the denial of the visa to the Financial Times Asia editor, Victor Mallet. In a way, although I feel very sad for him and for what it means for press freedom, they couldn't have picked a better paper in terms of making our case to the business community. You know, if it was, I don't know, Newsweek or Time, or, you know, it may worry the business community less. But the Financial Times, obviously, by definition, is the paper that the business community reads. And that ought to send an alarming message to them at this point.
I mean, sure, it's alarming, but like, there's so much money to be made.
Yeah, but if the money is not as secure as it used to be, if the rule of law and the basic freedoms that underpin what made Hong Kong special was that it was a safe place to make money and deposit money, and if confidence in Hong Kong begins to be eroded because of these things that are happening, and crucially the rule of law, then I think the business community will begin to have reason to be worried.
Were you, Benedict, in Hong Kong when Article 23 was going to be passed?
No, I left in 2002, and I think it was 2003 when it was first being talked about, and of course there were big protests against it, and it was then put on hold. But obviously there are concerns that it may well be brought in the next few years. But I wasn't there at that time.
I was just thinking about kind of like how the protests at that time were able to like halt, or at least temporarily pause, Article 23 and the idea that like mainland Chinese like anti-subversion laws would be applicable to Hong Kong. Versus now it seems much harder to be able to stop the kind of encroachment of like mainland law into Hong Kong just using protest.
I think that's right. And that's where I think, again, the business community could come into play, because I think, of course, business is not particularly interested in political activists being jailed. But I think they would be interested in and concerned about a law that potentially could affect their interests in terms of, I mean, who knows what the scope of Article 23 would be, but it may mean that companies who report on issues of corruption or release information that is regarded as politically sensitive could be affected. So I think, I mean, we've been doing quite a bit of thinking about this question of the business case on these issues, and I think Article 23 is probably the issue that will worry business.
Mm. Real quick, just for our audience, either Benedict or Shelley, do you want to give a quick summary of what Article 23 was and may be?
I can talk about it. I guess. Yeah, I mean, Article 23 is the clause in the Hong Kong Basic Law that would make it so that basically anti-subversion laws that are applicable in mainland China would also apply to Hong Kong. So I think the exact legal interpretation of it is not super clear. Mm-hmm. But at the time, people were protesting back in 2003 when the Hong Kong government was talking about enacting this article would be that it would basically make things that were illegal in mainland China for anti-subversion, quote-unquote, reasons, mm-hmm. illegal in Hong Kong as well. So let's say you were protesting the Tiananmen Square massacre. Like, maybe that would be considered subversive. Mm. Or maybe you practiced Falun Gong, which would be subversive in mainland China, but you can do legally in Hong Kong. Like, all these things would carry over from the mainland. And for people who were used to, like, a much greater degree of freedom and who were proud of the fact that they're the only place in China where you could protest, that might have been a little bit concerning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the clever things the CCP is doing here is that they were able to pass Article 23 in Macau. And so far as I know, they have not used it to go after dissidents in the way that they would in mainland China. And I think that they're when they try to push it again in Hong Kong, they can say, well, look, it's, you know, Article 23 was passed a decade ago in Macau, and, you know, look, no one there is in danger, so it's not a big deal when we pass it in Hong Kong. And then they'll pass it in Hong Kong, and then they'll actually enact it. Then they'll actually enforce some of those things once it's passed.
So, Benedict, do you think there is a risk that we might see Article 23 coming back to Hong Kong?
I think there's certainly a risk. I think one of the differences between Hong Kong and Macau, from my understanding of Macau, is that one of the reasons it hasn't been enforced there is that there isn't really a significant political dissident community in Macau in the way that there is in Hong Kong. So that's probably why it hasn't really been put into force. But yes, I think sooner or later there is a risk. And I actually think that we're seeing a sort of precursors of it already. I mean, the banning of the Hong Kong National Party, which was a tiny party that almost nobody had heard of, very few people in Hong Kong supported, led by a brave young activist, Andy Chan, who also nobody had heard of until he was banned. And it was a party that advocated Hong Kong independence. Now, my position is not advocating Hong Kong independence, but I do support freedom of expression, freedom of association. And the banning of Hong Kong, of the Hong Kong National Party, in a way is already a form of Article 23.
Mm. The excuse that the Hong Kong government gave was that they had advocated violence for independence, like the use of violence to achieve Hong Kong independence.
And I have certainly never heard them advocate that. I mean, if they have, I would not condone that. I would condemn that. But I am not aware of either Andy Chan or his party advocating that.
So are you saying that the CCP might be lying?
Well, it wouldn't be the first time.
Name 55 other examples.
Exactly.
Actually, I think it's interesting, Benedict, you're talking about the business community in Hong Kong, because what it actually made me think of was back again, maybe, was this as far back as 2006 or something? When was Rio Tinto? Do you remember, Matt?
Oh,
or
that's
Chris?
A good question. That was like 2010 or 11, I think.
There was a Chinese-Australian businessman, Stern Hu, who was an executive for Rio Tinto, the Australian mining company in China, who was arrested.
Sorry, who was the director?
I couldn't. He was on first. That's what happened.
Oh.
Okay, so it was 2009, I guess. But yeah, he was sentenced to prison for 10 years for, was it on a state secrets charge? Yeah, stealing commercial secrets and receiving bribes. But actually, he was recently released and reporting in the Financial Times, actually, made it pretty clear that his arrest and the whole commercial secrets thing might have really been just like a political move by the Chinese Communist Party to in their business dealings with Rio Tinto and about really like natural resources prices in Australia in general. So it was like a very interesting case where the kind of political, legal issues and business issues kind of all came together.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think it's really good that you've reminded listeners of that case. There was also, of course, the case, which I'm a little bit sketchy on the details on, but the case of the British businessman Peter Humphreys in China, who ended up in jail. And there have been a number of those kind of cases. So those are all reasons why business in Hong Kong ought to be concerned.
Oh, I remember reading Peter Humphreys had written an article in the Financial Times after he was released, talking actually about his experience in prison in China and also saying that Stern Hu was in the same prison that he was being held in.
Small world.
Right. Yes. Yes. And of course, I mean, now the president of Interpol has been jailed in China. So if they can go after the head of the International Police Organization, that anything's possible.
So with all this in mind, when's your next trip to Hong Kong?
Well, I actually went last night to the to a dinner for to mark the forthcoming Taiwan National Day, and I suddenly thought, because I saw the banner at the dinner saying the 107th anniversary of the Republic of China, and in brackets, Taiwan. And I thought, so it's not the case that I'm banned from China. I'm banned from communist-occupied China and from Hong Kong. But I, as far as I know, the Taiwanese are my friends, and I'm not banned there. So I'm not banned from China.
I like that. That's the same thing for us. We're not banned from China. Well, I wouldn't want to give the audience the impression that you're only involved in Hong Kong issues. You're also, you're interested in many, many things. How about we switch to talking a little bit about the situation with Christians in China? I know you're very engaged in that community. Why don't you tell us a bit about that, and what do you think about the recent Vatican stuff?
Well, I'm very engaged with the whole situation for in terms of violations and repression of religious freedom overall. So I'm concerned about what's happening in Xinjiang, what's happening in Tibet, the continuing persecution of Falun Gong practitioners. But yes, you're right. I am concerned about what's happening to Christians. And I would say that, so, I mean, I think what we're witnessing now is the worst crackdown on religion generally, but on Christianity in particular, some would say since the Cultural Revolution. And it was interesting, the day before the Vatican announced its deal with China, the Catholic Herald, which is obviously, as the name suggests, a Catholic magazine in the UK, carried an article I'd written for them as the cover story. And the headline they had on the cover was China's War on Christianity. And they had actually an amazing graphic that I'm sure your listeners would love to see if you could show it in a podcast. But it had this amazing image of a huge dragon breathing down on this tiny church with sort of people scurrying out of the church. But basically, we've seen thousands of crosses destroyed, many churches either forced to close or in some instances actually dynamited and destroyed. Christians arrested. And crucially, as well as the crackdown on religious practice itself, there's also been a crackdown on human rights lawyers, many of whom are Christians or have been involved in defending Christians. And there have been new regulations, both at the beginning of this year, tightening up restrictions on religious practice, and then new regulations just very recently on online religious activity. So it's a really serious situation.
And do you think the deal the Pope made is going to change any of that?
Well, I have a lot of concerns about the deal, partly the substance of the deal, but my bigger concern is the timing of it. I mean, why do a deal in the middle of what I've, as I've just described, is the worst crackdown for decades? And I'm not at all optimistic. I mean, we were talking earlier about China's blatant inability to honor its commitments under the Joint Declaration in the case of Hong Kong. So I'm not optimistic that China will honor its side of the bargain in this context. I think the only thing that gives me a little bit of reassurance is that the Vatican has said it's a provisional arrangement, and that if it doesn't work after a period of time, they'll review it and abandon it if necessary. I'm very concerned about it. If I'm proven wrong and it works, then of course I'd be glad. But I'm not hopeful about it.
Do you think that the Vatican is going to switch diplomatic alliances from the Republic of China to the People's Republic of China?
Well, my one relief, I suppose, when they announced this arrangement was that that wasn't a part of it, at least at this stage. I really hope that doesn't happen, because the Vatican is one of the few dwindling number of states around the world that still maintains formal ties with Taiwan, and I would like that to continue. I think we have to be prepared for the possibility that they may switch if this deal is to go forward. But I hope they can work something out to give Taiwan some reassurances as well. So let's wait and see. But we have to be prepared for it, but I hope it doesn't happen.
So what does this new deal do?
Well, the full text hasn't been released, but from what I've understood through news reports, it means that the situation that's existed until now is that there's been a state-approved Catholic Church that is under the control of the government and not in communion with Rome, not under the authority of the Pope, and then an underground Catholic Church that is in communion with the Pope. And what I think this deal is intended to do is that the Chinese government will be involved in nominating candidates for bishops. That's been the impasse between them for all these decades. So the Chinese government will have some say in the nomination of candidates for bishops, but that apparently the Pope will have the final say. I guess in principle, it's not ideal, but it's not disastrous. But in practice, can we really imagine the Pope vetoing nominations? Let's wait and see. Obviously, the intention is to try to bring the state-controlled church and the underground church together into one church under the authority of the Pope. And I suppose, from the Vatican's point of view, the one good thing this deal does is it does acknowledge the authority of the Pope, which is a step forward in some level. But it also means the Chinese Communist Party, which is an atheist party, is involved in nominating Catholic bishops, which is rather strange. It's interesting, there's a very well-known and well-respected American Catholic commentator called George Weigel, who was the biographer of John Paul II. And he wrote an article around the time when this deal was announced, reminding people that this year is the 85th anniversary of what was called the Reichskonkordat. Forgive my German accent or lack of. But the agreement between the Vatican and Nazi Germany, and that didn't turn out very well either. So it doesn't bode well, I think.
It's almost as if history repeats itself.
Exactly.
No, it's going to be different this time. Mm. It's always going to be different. Now, in terms of the bishops, it seems like what the Pope is doing is he's willing to approve the bishops that were already selected by the Communist Party rather than the Communist Party accepting bishops that the Pope wants.
Yes. And that's certainly what's happened so far, and that's also a big concern. And I know the Vatican asked some of the bishops who were recognized by Rome to stand down in favor of Communist Party approved bishops.
I remember we'd done an episode on this for China Uncensored earlier this year, and Chris had mentioned that there were seven Chinese state-approved bishops that the Pope was going to recognize, and one of them had been excommunicated, and two of them apparently had families somehow. So it
wasn't... Well, I think we know how that somehow happened, Matt.
Yes. Like, maybe not like the best image for the Catholic Church. Yes.
Oh, I see where Chris was going with this joke.
Okay. Catholic school education.
The thing that kind of stuns me about this deal is, I mean, I can understand that the Vatican wants to maintain some semblance of control in a certain way, and maybe they've decided that some control is better than none. But ultimately, there's no way that the Chinese Communist Party is going to be okay in the long term mm-hmm. with the allegiance of these bishops in China being to the Pope.
Absolutely. I think and I one of the voices in this that I feel very sad has been completely ignored and sort of sidelined is Cardinal Zen in Hong Kong, who has spoken out very strongly over many years, and he's the one Chinese, you know, he's originally from Shanghai, although he became the Cardinal of Hong Kong. He's the one person in the Catholic Church worldwide who really knows the Chinese Communist Party and how they work. And the Vatican has refused to take on board both his concerns, but also his experience and wisdom.
And I think you make a good point comparing it to the situation in Hong Kong. Like, we've seen over the years that the Chinese Communist Party does not honor any of its commitments. And so you make a good point. If it came to a situation where this deal goes through and the Pope says, like, oh, no, I'm going to veto this bishop the Communist Party appoints, the Communist Party holds all the cards. It would just go back to, well, if you're not going to approve him, then this whole deal goes down, and there you have it.
We end up with the Panchen Lama of bishops, basically.
Exactly.
Yes.
Quick history of Panchen Lama, Shelley?
Oh, the number two not Lama of Tibetan Buddhism, who was mysteriously kidnapped as a child.
And then the Communist Party appointed their own replacement.
No, they found another kid who was the real reincarnation mm-hmm. of the Panchen Lama.
Whose job it will be to find the next Dalai Lama.
Yes.
I mean, look, if anyone truly understands reincarnation, it's the atheist Communist Party.
That's right. They've even made laws regulating reincarnation.
So. Plus, the Panchen Lama now gets to come out and, like, you know, bless the Tibetan people and talk about how socialism with Chinese characteristic and the Chinese Communist Party has the interests of the Tibetans at heart.
Yeah, good point. Benedict, do you have any sense of how ordinary Catholics, both in China and around the world, are reacting to this?
The vast majority of people that I've heard from, I haven't been in direct contact with Catholics in mainland China, but I've certainly read articles about them, but other Catholics around the world, the vast majority, I think, are very concerned and surprised. I think opinion is divided, and people would say, well, let's give it a chance, and we understand the Vatican's motivation behind it. Other people will say the Vatican's making a huge mistake. But I think most people that I hear from, to varying degrees, would be very, very cautious about this, and would not be very hopeful of this working out with the regime as we know it in China today.
Well, Benedict, I feel very horribly depressed. Thank you.
it is hard to it's hard to see too much room for. I mean, I am generally an optimistic person, but when you look at what's happening on human rights across the board in China, including religious freedom, this deal that we've just been talking about, what's happening in Hong Kong, the pressure on Taiwan coming from the mainland, and the pressure indeed internationally, as we talked earlier, there's not a great deal of cause for optimism. I think the people that I have the privilege of working with, particularly the people that were just in the UK last week from Hong Kong, and others like them, they're my one source of hope. But the situation is not hopeful at all. Mm.
Well, I know there's so many things we could talk to you about, but so since you say you're an optimist, can you leave us something to be optimistic about, a spoonful of sugar, if you will, to let the medicine go down?
Well, I think what I would say is that I've been involved in human rights work in a range of different countries for all of my adult life. And I've seen, even in my lifetime, situations that you never expected to change suddenly do. So I was involved, for example, in East Timor. And when I first got involved in East Timor, people said, you're wasting your time. It's a losing battle. East Timor will never be free. And it was. The Maldives I got involved with, and they've had two now. I was involved with the Maldives when it went through its first transition to democracy, which lasted 4 years and then was overthrown in a coup. But now this latest election, I don't know if you've followed it at all, but the existing dictator did everything he possibly could to rig the election. I mean, you name it, he did it. And still the democratic opposition managed to win. And I need to talk to my Maldivian friends about how they managed to do that when he did everything possible to rig it. So there are situations that you think seem hopeless, and in fact they surprise you and things change. So I'm hopeful that that time will come at some point, although none of us can predict when, for China, for Hong Kong, and for the rest of that region. Mm-hmm.
And do you think democracy will ever come to the UK?
Well, I think let's see what happens after Brexit. But
let's not get into that. Paul Hatch.
I know. I promised myself I wasn't going to say the word Brexit in this interview, and I broke that promise. So, but not quite on the level of Chinese broken promises.
No, not anywhere near. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Benedict. We should get you on again because, again, I know there's so much we could talk to you about. Yeah, any final farewell to the audience?
No, it's been a privilege and a pleasure to be with you, as always. I've always admired your shows and great to be with you.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
No, Benedict, can you tell us about Hong Kong Watch?
Sure. So Hong Kong Watch was set up less than a year ago. We launched it in December last year. I set it up with a number of friends because we felt very strongly that there was a real need for an organization to speak up for Hong Kong, first and foremost in the UK because of the UK's obvious responsibilities, but longer term we want to have more of an international reach. We're already developing contacts in the States and in Canada and in Europe and elsewhere. We're totally cross-party, so we have five patrons in the UK from right across the political spectrum, former foreign minister Sir Malcolm Rifkind, former leader of the Liberal Democrat Party Paddy Ashdown, a Labour MP, an independent member of the House of Lords, Lord Alton, and the man who prosecuted Slobodan Milosevic, a lawyer called Sir Geoffrey Knight. Those are our five patrons. And we're involved in producing research and briefings, reports, and advocating to parliamentarians, policymakers, the media, to try and raise awareness about what's happening in Hong Kong.
So if our audience wanted to learn more about what's happening in Hong Kong, they could go to your website?
They certainly could. The website is hongkongwatch.org. We also have a Facebook page, and in fact, the video of the wonderful woman last week who helped inadvertently promote our work and the issues in Hong Kong at the Conservative Party conference, that video is on our Facebook page, and I forget how many shares and views it had, but it went into huge numbers, and we're very grateful to her. Name is Kong Lin Lin, and we should thank her.
Once again, thank you for joining us today, Benedict.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that does it for today's China Unscripted. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
I'm Matt Ganeshda.
Talk to you next time.